The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thanks for taking the time to be here this evening. When we assess a nonprofit organization, we look at their theory of change, the measurable impact their programs have had, and how efficiently and wisely they allocate their dollars. But rarely do we discuss the effectiveness of their board of trustees. But we should. And tonight we will, with Ann Wallestead, the president and CEO of BoardSource. She'll tell us what good boards do, but also some of the mistakes that many of them commonly make.
One is around expectations. You know, so how do you really make sure that when you're bringing on new board members and you're orienting them to what it means to be a strong board leader, that you're actually getting those expectations well aligned and that everybody knows exactly what's needed of them? I think a huge mistake that a lot of organizations make is that they really undersell the commitment of board service.
You'll also hear from Carrie Brody, the founder of Emma's Torch, a nonprofit social enterprise that provides culinary training and job placement services to refugees and survivors of human trafficking. And our Better Than Most segment will feature the wonderful corporate culture of Dream, whose mission is to provide inner-city youth with opportunities to play, learn, and grow. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, December 3rd. People gave an estimated $274 million to charitable causes online this Giving Tuesday, with more than 2 million digital donations processed, the largest outpouring ever for the event. The number far exceeded the $177 million raised last year on Giving Tuesday. Supporters of Donald J. Trump account for at least a third of millennials surveyed and are among the most actively involved of their generation, a research brief from Achieve and the Case Foundation finds. Facebook will eliminate its 5% transaction fee for charitable donations made on the site, company co-founder Mark Zuckerberg announced Wednesday, putting millions of additional dollars into the hands of nonprofits annually. And finally, in the world of philanthropy, one of the most anticipated reports is Giving in Numbers, issued by CECP, the CEO Force for Good, in partnership with the Conference Board. It's an in-depth analysis of corporate giving and employee engagement data from the world's largest companies. And here to share some of the highlights with us are Daryl Brewster, the Chief Executive Officer of CECP, and Carmen Perez, their Director of Data Insights. Thank you both for being here this evening.
Delighted to be here back on the air with you, Denver. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Denver.
Let me start with you, Daryl, by taking a look at the big picture. And that would be total giving by corporations in 2016. How does it compare to the earlier period?
Well, Denver, once again, we saw an increase over the last couple of years in terms of total corporate giving per the CECP survey. It's up about 2% in 2016. And we also found that the top quartile companies, that's the top 25%, continued to grow. We call them, they were up to $53 million on average, nearly 2% of pre-tax income. So we think, you know, good increase among the overall and among the largest companies. Median giving among the 256 companies that were in the survey was just shy of $20 million, or about 1% of pre-tax income.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daryl, what industries helped drive this overall increase? And conversely, were there some that retreated a little bit in their overall giving?
Yeah, the healthcare industry as a whole made a big impact, both on terms of increases as well as decreases in the past year. Pharma companies drove the largest proportion of aggregate total giving. They were really drivers of that increase that we talked about. On the other hand, medical equipment subsidiaries really were actually three-quarters of the decline. So given some of the concerns, I think, over the healthcare bill and other factors, we saw some pretty big swings in the healthcare industry. In total, though, we saw overall spend up again this year.
Very interesting. Carmen, what kind or type of nonprofit organizations registered the largest percentage increase as a result of corporate giving in 2016?
That's a really good question, because CECP is in a position to take a look at which social issues companies are giving the most to. Could be education, could be healthcare. But over the past 3 years, what we saw actually was a really big jump in culture and the arts. So that could be anything from a local community arts education organization all the way up to some of the bigger museums, major symphonies and music, up 48%. So that'd be like a company giving $1 million to culture and the arts in 2014 and jumping that all the way up to $1.5 million in 2016.
Wow. As it pertains to strategy, do you see any tendencies on the part of corporations as to how they go about their giving or the relationships that they're forging with partner organizations?
Yeah, we definitely see companies always seeking greater efficiency, to be more strategic, always more deeply connecting it back to their core business. In the case of culture and the arts, which we just spoke about, it could be that making sure employee needs are addressed is part of that strategy. But one major trend from giving in numbers that we also spoke about is these deeper partnerships. So as companies connect back to core business, become more strategic, they may seek to have fewer partners and be able to make larger grants. So we have all the numbers for you in giving in numbers to break that down, but it's a sign of how companies want to go deeper and make some big change on social issues. Another is that, you know, they're allocating higher proportions of their overall giving to their top strategic or signature program area. So a company might say, we really want to make some big change on diabetes. We really want to make some big change on the opioid crisis. And we can see that what they're saying, their key issues are matching where their dollars are going.
Greater focus. Were there any other things around their giving that are worth noting?
So one thing which is really important, I think, especially knowing that we're dealing with corporate givers in giving in numbers, and that CCP is always thinking about our coalition of over 200 companies, how they're being more strategic on this. One way that we see that playing out is through their measurement. So if you work in a corporate environment, you know KPIs, hitting quarterly goals, hitting long-term goals are all part of the puzzle. That happens in the societal programs as well. So we like to see how our company is moving and advancing their measurements. That can be not just looking at how many people might be trained in a particular social program, like a workforce program, but, you know, did they go on to get that job? Did they actually increase their skills? And that's about measuring the outcomes. And every year we're seeing that tick up more and more. So over the most recent period in giving in numbers, we saw that going from 85% of companies measuring those outcomes all the way up to 87%. So continually ticking up year over year.
Yeah, that's a definite trend. Finally, Daryl, this was a review of corporate giving data for 2016. What's your sense of it for the current year, and what do you anticipate the picture to be in 2018?
Yeah, great question, Denver. You know, each year, in addition to the survey, CCP talks with over 100 companies every month. And it really gives us a great perspective about what companies are talking about, where they're focusing, where their great interests are. And of course, you know, the past year has been a year of great change, uncertainty, increasing influence from the millennial generation, and a number of unfortunate disasters that we hit with the hurricanes that hit so many parts of the U.S. this year. Three areas that we're really seeing from companies. One is that companies in this area are really taking a role of responsibility that sometimes in the past may have been more of a governmental role, but businesses are stepping up. We saw that particularly in disaster relief over the last year. Walmart, in their quarterly call with investors, talked about the $83 million that they've spent in Puerto Rico over the last year, half from Walmart, half raised from their customers, really making an impact and a very important impact on that island, along with companies like UPS and others that are continuing to work in the restoration and relief in Texas and Florida as well. So companies stepping up is a big topic. A second area we're hearing is this real focus on purpose in the workplace, work purpose in the job, that consumers and employees, particularly millennials, are looking for meaning beyond just work. And we're delighted to be part of a purpose project with PwC, the accounting firm, nationwide listening tour underway, so we can share best practices and learning on that. We're very excited. In fact, our team is in San Francisco today. We'll be in San Jose tomorrow, really getting the insights. How do you infuse purpose into today's workforce? And finally, we're starting to see companies and major investors start pushing back on a lot of the short-termism of Wall Street. That's still the prevailing feel, but we are seeing companies like Vanguard, BlackRock, State Street, asking companies to share longer-term plans. If you're only in the short term, then a lot of the social things we've talked about aren't as important. But if you're thinking about the long haul of building sustainable business over time, then these become increasingly important. So at CECP, we're really delighted to be working with a number of major investors, as well as leading companies that encourage them to share their long-term plans and how they're going to deal with environmental, social, and governance issues to build sustainable business, not just short-term quarterly results.
Well, we've just touched upon a few of the highlights here, Daryl. Is there a place to go where listeners can access the full Giving in Numbers report?
Absolutely. If you go to cecp.co, that's as in Chief Executive Corporate Purpose.co, as in coordination or cooperation, you can get that report, the survey, as well as other facts and figures from CECP, and it's over 200 companies.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both for being here this evening and sharing these findings with us.
Great. Thank you, Denver. Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on to 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful, because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
With nearly one in four New Yorkers struggling to meet their most basic needs, we know our city is facing a crisis. But did you know that our highest poverty rates are among women and mothers? These women don't need handouts. They need a hand up. That's why Grameen America provides
Welcome
tens of thousands of women
of
across our city with
Denver
the loan
Frederick.
Capital they need to start their own small businesses. With the gift of entrepreneurship, these women have the opportunity to escape poverty, provide for their children, and gain independence. Join the movement today. Invest in New York City by investing in them. Visit GrameenAmerica.org to learn more.
Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
When Darren Walker, the president of the Ford Foundation, was on the show, he said the following: everything that is right or wrong with an organization, whether a for-profit or nonprofit, can be traced to the doorstep of the Board of Trustees. It all begins with the board. The recognized leader in nonprofit board leadership, as well as supporting, training, and educating nonprofit leaders from across the country and throughout the world, is an organization called BoardSource. And it is a great pleasure to have with us this evening their president and CEO, Ann Wallestead. Good evening, Ann, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Provide us with some of the history of BoardSource and how it came upon this all-important mission.
Sure. So BoardSource is about 30 years of age. We were founded actually by the Association of Governing Boards of Colleges and Universities and the independent sector. And as the story goes, folks were going to AGB and asking for support around their boards of directors. And AGB said, well, but we only work with colleges and universities. Surely there must be someplace else for folks to go. And in fact, there were not. They turned around to independent sector, again, as the story goes, and said, you know, you must help folks. And IS said, no, that's not what we do either. And so they got together and started what was then the National Center for Nonprofit Boards as a project of AGB's. And then a couple of years after that, decided that there really was a need for us to be an independent organization. And so the National Center for Nonprofit Boards became its own organization in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been focused on this mission of how do we strengthen nonprofit boards and position them to really provide the leadership that social sector organizations need to do their best work ever since then.
And what are some of the common mistakes that boards, and I'm even talking about good boards, frequently make?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that boards can do wrong, but I try really hard not to pick on them too much because there's also a lot that boards do really well. But I think when we're looking at the things that tend to create dysfunction or lack of achievement when it comes to boards, it really comes down to two things or two categories. One is around expectations. You know, so how do you really make sure that when you're bringing on new board members and you're orienting them to what it means to be a strong board leader, that you're actually getting those expectations well aligned and that everybody knows exactly what's needed of them. I think a huge mistake that a lot of organizations make is that they really undersell the commitment of board service. And then, of course, they're disappointed when they turn around and, you know, somebody says, well, I'm giving you exactly what you asked for. You just didn't ask for very much.
No, what they really wanted was a yes. And they undersell it to get that yes.
That's right. That's exactly right. And the second category I would say is, you know, once folks are on board, really not taking the time to effectively engage people. And I don't mean engagement for engagement's sake, you know, making folks feel good about their board service. I really mean thinking about the highest and best use of the board. Mm-hmm. And how do we really take advantage of and leverage all of the work that we've hopefully done to get the right people around the table, to get the right people leading the organization at the board level and making sure that we're really tapping into that insight and expertise rather than just going through the motions and creating a scenario where you've got all of this talent that you're just not tapping into. And unfortunately, that happens way, way too much.
Oh, I know that well. Let's talk about some of the current issues with boards in the nonprofit sector. There's a real dissatisfaction regarding board diversity. Mm-hmm. Now, many organizations acknowledge this and have expressed a desire and an intent to address it. But I know you, BoardSource, have recently issued quite a comprehensive report looking at this very issue. Is any progress being made?
Well, the sad truth is very, very little. BoardSource started first looking at the demographics of board composition with a study that we did in 1994. So, you know, more than 20 years ago. And we've made really tiny progress since then. We've moved the needle only very slightly when it comes to the racial and ethnic diversity of boards. And the current findings as of the 2017 study are that boards are 84% white in terms of the racial and ethnic makeup. And even more striking, 27% of all boards are actually 100% white.
Wow.
So, you know, there's a real challenge in terms of getting boards to a place where not only they are more representative of the communities that they are serving, but that they really have the perspective that they need in the boardroom to be able to make good decisions and strategy for an organization that don't have huge gaps in terms of perspective, insight, network. And we think those potential strategic blind spots are real issue.
Yeah, I think what was really striking about this most recent report is that those numbers were actually worse in terms of diversity than they were in 2015.
That's
so it's
right.
Not as if a progress is being made slowly.
Right.
It's almost as if it's in reverse.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're really not seeing the movement that we would hope to be seeing in terms of becoming more diverse. And of course, we wanted to understand, well, why might that be? And so we took a look at some of the practices of boards to see if there's anything that we could learn about, you know, why haven't we made more progress? And it's actually it's disappointing, but it's a very straightforward answer, and that is organizations, boards are simply not prioritizing demographics in board recruitment. And even more striking is there's real dissonance in terms of what boards and executives are saying is important to them in terms of diversity and what they're actually doing. Close to 1 in 5 of all of the executives that responded to the Leading with Intent survey indicated both that they were unhappy with the level of racial and ethnic diversity that they had on their board and that they were not prioritizing demographics in board recruitment. So when you think about the fact that 1 in 5 of all organizations that responded said, we're not happy, we're not doing anything about it.
Yeah.
That's a huge challenge.
That
but
really
you really
is.
Don't have to look any further to understand why we haven't made more progress.
Well, absolutely right. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about measuring the impact of nonprofit organizations' program work, and everybody's looking to evaluate their effectiveness and make it better. How prevalent is that practice among boards themselves? Assessing their own performance as it relates to their key responsibilities.
It's not happening as much as we would like it to. Boards are not doing regular and rigorous board self-assessment. And I would add, boards are also not very good about regularly and formally assessing the performance of executives. Mm. So, you know, certainly the majority are, but a huge percentage are not. And that's a real challenge in terms of being a performance-oriented organization. The thing that I'll add there that is really fascinating is when it comes to board self-assessment, there seems to be, or the data suggests, that there's a real connection between those boards that are assessing their own performance and those boards that rate their performance higher. So, you know, you can't say that there's causation there, but there certainly is a relationship between those organizations and boards that are being thoughtful about their performance and those that are doing better. And we can actually see that there is a stronger relationship for those that have done it more recently. So it does matter. It's not just a waste of effort.
Absolutely.
It's not a waste of time.
That's a very interesting observation. And I also bet within these organizations, too, that the performance review process for the staff is not going to be that good or rigorous when the CEO themselves are not being reviewed by the board. It kind of is going to trickle down in more cases than not.
It certainly could. We don't ask questions about the evaluation practices for the rest of the staff. But I do think just as it's challenging to not have both the board and the executive being assessed, it's challenging to have a staff be assessed and not have the executive.
Right. There's an awful lot of clamor for greater collaboration. You can't pick up an article and not see somewhere in the piece we need more collaboration in the sector between and among organizations. Let's eliminate some of the duplication. Let's get better outcomes. But often left out of all these things that I look at is the role of the board and how their mindsets needs to change in order for these collaborations to really be meaningful. How does a board need to alter their perspective and orientation?
That's a great question, and it's something that I think a lot about and I think is really important for more of us to think about. And I guess I would start with how are we defining success and how are boards defining success? And if we have a really narrow definition and are looking only at, what has this organization in the most narrow sense accomplished, that is not necessarily an orientation that encourages a leader or an organization to invest in collaboration. Collaboration requires an openness, a level of comfort with lack of certainty, a willingness to experiment, a willingness to take risk, a willingness to define your success not only by what you've accomplished but what you have enabled to make happen. And that is not necessarily the way that, even we board source have trained boards to think. We need to, in my opinion, really open up the way that we think about what our organizations are designed to do and what and how that requires us to operate differently.
Yeah, that's really, really hard, but it is so critical and important. I mean, one thing that I've seen is encouraging is that younger people tend to look at these things from an issue perspective, where the older you are, you sometimes tend to look at them from an organizational perspective. I think it's just our whole idea of we had our Rolodex and they have their whole, everything's out on Facebook. There's a sense that it's more open. And I think that that is hopefully a positive trend for the future. But I've really seen that in a lot of different places.
Well, I certainly agree with the sentiment that thinking about issue or, the word I would use is purpose.
Yeah.
And really, what are we trying to accomplish? Thinking about that first instead of the concept of, who are we as an organizational entity and what are we trying to or what have we been doing type of orientation is really important. And this is not a, original Ann Wollaston thought. Plenty of other folks have said this. There's great work talking about the networked leader and the way that leaders can operate differently and really position their organization to be better at collaboration by thinking that way. And I do think that boards need to recalibrate around what that takes in terms of the relationship between the board and the executive in terms of trust and flexibility. I also think it goes back to the way that we think about strategic planning. And, if we're focused on predicting what we should accomplish, that's really going to limit us in terms of what we are able to do. It shouldn't be about predicting what we can do. It should be about remaining open to what's possible.
Absolutely. One of our favorite themes on the Business of Giving is corporate culture of nonprofit organizations. As a matter of fact, I had the great pleasure to visit your place, and you have a wonderful one down there. But we've never really examined the leadership culture and dynamics of the board of directors and how it conducts its work. But you have. What are some of those insights?
Yeah, we talk about culture as being the secret sauce of boards and really what makes a difference in terms of how boards operate and how they perform. Leading with Intent asks a lot of questions questions related to board culture and what really defines a positive culture. And we did some interesting things with this particular study to take a peek at what might matter most, particularly as it relates to overall organizational performance. And the thing that stood out from a culture perspective was the extent to which the board operates as a collaborative team working towards shared goals, which sounds a little squishy, but it turns out really, really matters, which is probably no surprise to anyone. But to see it in stark relief in terms of the data, I think is important. And it also, to me, is a real signal that boards that miss the opportunity to invest in that culture are really putting the effectiveness of the board at risk. We asked some questions related to how much is the board investing in social time between board members and being really intentional about building the team. You know, some boards are meeting only 3 or 4 times a year. If you need that group of people to operate as a team, you need to be intentional about building that bond.
Mm-hmm.
And those were some of the questions that got the lowest responses in the affirmative in terms of those investments in social time. So when you see how important it is and you see that it's not necessarily happening as much as we would like to, I think that's a real opportunity for boards to think about some high leverage investments in change.
That makes a lot of sense. You recently held your Board Source Leadership Forum, which was attended by 1,000 social sector leaders. Another sellout. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And at this forum, you touched upon 4 things that you believe organizations need to do to unlock their full potential. And if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you to say a word about each one, if you would. The first was purpose. And this is not the same as the mission statement, is it?
That's right. We talk about purpose as that deeper level of understanding about what your organization is really seeking to accomplish in the world. And the reason we use that word instead of mission statement is, you know, folks get really wrapped up in here's what our mission statement says. And mission statements often are actually more of a description of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're not necessarily capturing the reason for existence. And that's what I mean when we talk about purpose. And, you know, for some organizations, that really goes back to the reason that they were founded. For others, the purpose has shifted over time, and that's okay. But it's really understanding, why are we here? Why do we do the work that we do? And one of the things that I think is so powerful about focusing on purpose is there is an opportunity to think about purpose-aligned organizations in a different way. When you're thinking about mission statement or organizational structure, you're thinking about brand and unit-level success.
That's right.
When you're thinking about purpose, you're thinking about what are we seeking to accomplish and who can help us. And I think that is a subtle but really powerful shift for organizations to be thinking about and talking about at the board level.
Yeah, it's the why of the organization.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
The second thing is for an organization to define its values and live into them. And the last part of that statement is really key, isn't it?
Absolutely. What's the point of having values if they don't actually mean something in terms of the way that your organization operates? I told the story at the conference about a story that a lot of business school professors tell, and they talk about corporate values and they share these 4 words: communication, respect, integrity, and excellence. And then they turn around and ask their students, you know, what's wrong with these? And of course, everyone's confused because there's nothing wrong with them and, you know, what could possibly be wrong with them. But then the professors will go on and say, well, you know, actually, what's wrong with these is that they were Enron's corporate values in the midst of a huge, you know, corporate ethics scandal. And the point being that the values, organizational values, need to really come from what an organization has committed itself to do and to be, and they need to live them with each and every decision that they make.
Mm-hmm. I thought your third recommendation was most interesting, which is cultivate resilience through flexibility. Speak to that.
Well, you know, I'm a firm believer that there is just no strength in rigidity or predetermined plans that do not acknowledge that we are in a constant state of change and flux. And I think that we can really get into a trap. Any organization can get into the trap of thinking, you know, well, here's what we want to accomplish 3 years from now. Here's how we're going to do it. And these are all of the steps and sort of tactics that we're going to put into place. And it's, you know, it's almost laughable.
Hmm.
It really doesn't reflect the reality of how our organizations and our world exists. And I think it sets boards and staffs up for failure in some ways in terms of thinking, you know, well, is it about what we said we were going to do? Or is it about what is the right thing to do in this moment? And so we really encourage boards to think, you know, how do you build some sense of shared understanding about the direction that you're headed and really get clear about what's most important for you to do, but then leave a whole lot of flexibility about how you get it done.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people would have anticipated 3 years ago that Donald Trump would be president, as an example. So you have to be able to pivot and adjust some of your plans according to that. Your final thought was build power and influence, and perhaps that message has never been more important than now.
Well, I certainly think that's right. You know, BoardSource as an organization, we've been talking about the importance of power in the public policy context for a number of years. We launched a campaign several years ago called the Stand for Your Mission campaign, which is really focused on helping board members understand the role that nonprofits can and should play in public policy and helping board members themselves understand how they as individuals can really play a powerful role as advocates for their mission. Well, when you're talking about all of the things that nonprofits are facing in terms of radical shifts or potential shifts in public support, policy changes that are impacting the communities that they serve and the ways in which they do their work, you know, to your point, really never has there been a more important time to talk about that.
And now you have this Stand for Your Mission Awards.
That's right. We announced at the conference that we are inviting organizations to apply for the Stand for Your Mission Award, which will honor an organization that really is standing for its mission and that has thoughtfully engaged the board in that work of advocacy.
Very cool. Let's move on to another issue. You know, a frequently debated topic in the sector is fundraising effectiveness. Now, many will argue that how much of each dollar goes to program is really a poor proxy for impact, although I think most donors and average donors look at that still more than any other. On the other side of the spectrum, people will say, hey, don't worry about how much money you spend. Your job is to accumulate as much as you can to serve the mission. BoardSource, along with some of your colleagues in the sector, have developed a new framework for measuring fundraising effectiveness. What does that look like?
Yeah, so, you know, the dynamic that you're articulating in terms of, you know, some folks saying cost of fundraising shouldn't matter at all. Other folks looking at it as, you know, not just a good measure of fundraising effectiveness, but a good measure of organizational effectiveness.
Which the is, measure.
Which is, from my perspective, so wildly off base. But we saw that there was a real need to make sense of that or to attempt to make sense of that, both for boards and for the public. And so you mentioned colleague organizations. This is a joint initiative with GuideStar, BBB Wise Giving Alliance, and the Association of Fundraising Professionals. And what we came up with was a very, very simple way of articulating the risks associated with overemphasizing cost of fundraising. So we introduced something that we call the dependency quotient, which is a measure of the extent to which an organization is dependent on its top five donors. And the point that we're trying to make is that sometimes in an effort to spend as little as possible on fundraising, we are actually under-resourcing the very tactics and approaches to fundraising that give us resilience, flexibility, sustainability for our organizations. And so we want boards to understand that. Mm-hmm. So we created this initiative with this very simple framework. And then what's really most powerful about it, at least in my opinion, is a discussion guide that we created for boards to actually talk about it.
Oh, very good and much needed. Sticking with fundraising for a second, what is BoardSource's business model and what are your streams of revenue that support the work of the organization?
Well, it's certainly shifted and changed over our 30 years of existence. But the way that we operate now is really we're a 501c3 organization ourselves, but we have a really sort of hybrid model in terms of the way that we support our work. So we have programs, services that we offer to individual organizations and leaders, some of the things that probably folks are most familiar with when they think of BoardSource, board self-assessment, consulting services, publications. Those are fee-based. We are fortunate that thanks to the efforts of the past several years, those programs actually support themselves. And so we rely on philanthropic support to do things like leading with intent, investing in research, and then all of this growing leadership agenda that's really focused on where are there these these opportunities for us sector-wide that, you know, boards aren't necessarily thinking about, but they should be.
Yeah.
So it's a combination that for us has been quite powerful in terms of unlocking our full leadership potential and our ability to really create and push for culture change at the board level.
Let me get your take on this, and I don't know if Board Source has ever done any study on this, so it may be your own personal opinion, but it has to do with the ability of the sector to attract and retain talent. You know, there was an article I read in Fast Company the other day that suggested that social good and purpose-driven organizations are really beginning to poach some of the very best talent from nonprofits organizations over to them. Do you see this as a real concern?
You know, it's interesting. I don't have a lot of we don't have any of our own research on it, but certainly I pay attention just, you know, thinking as a nonprofit CEO and a CEO who is thinking about the sector as a whole. You know, it used to be that when folks were going into their careers, if they wanted to make a difference, if they felt like, you know, I'm about social good, the place that they naturally felt that they should land was in the nonprofit sector, mm-hmm. or perhaps in the public sector, in government or public service. That's really shifted, and there's plenty of other evidence mm-hmm. around that. And folks coming into the workforce are sector agnostic, or many are sector agnostic in terms of where they feel they can have the biggest impact. I do think that as leaders of nonprofit organizations, that means we need to think differently about the way that we operate and the way that we compete for talent, and we need to think about talent more than we do, and really being thoughtful, and there is a board role here, you know, making sure that we have talent strategies. And I'm not sure that that's something that nonprofits have typically, at least historically, spent as much time thinking about. It was sort of, well, if people want to do good, they'll come. And if they don't, that's okay, because we got plenty who will. Yeah. And I just don't think that's the way that things are going to be.
No. They got a lot of competition. There's a war on talent. And I think, again, if you look at millennials, they just want to do good in this world. And the rest of it is just a decision an organization makes with the IRS as to how they're going to form their organization.
That's right.
Let me close with this, Anne. Every industry is going through incredible disruption, and they're doing so at an unprecedented rate. And philanthropy, certainly a nonprofit sector, will be no exception. What do you hope for and aspire to see in the boards of this sector in terms of being able to navigate the turbulent waters that lay ahead?
Oh, what a fun, great question. You know, I go back to what you asked me initially in terms of the big challenges or mistakes that boards make. I really hope that boards can become what they were always designed to be, or at least what I think they were always designed to be, which is a group of thoughtful, talented leaders from all walks of life with lots of different exposure, perspective, experience, coming together around a common goal, a common purpose, and really truly leveraging all that they can do for an organization. And there's obviously a ton wrapped into that. But I think, you know, helping boards understand that they are not there just to prevent bad things from happening. They are there to make sure that good things do. And that means really moving beyond kind of the role of the board as risk prevention. That's still important.
Mm-hmm.
But that is, in my opinion, a relatively small, it's an important but small portion of what boards really need to be doing. And thinking about how do we lead more in community? How do we expand our way of thinking about our leadership beyond what happens around the boardroom table and really become the connection to community, the insight in terms of dynamics, trends, changes, the seeing around corners, the thinking differently outside of the social sector industry. I just think that there's such chemistry and power in what that could be. And you see it sometimes. We don't see it enough. But when you see it, it is so incredibly powerful. And I hope that every organization can have that.
That's great. Well, Anne Wallestead, the president and CEO of BoardSource, I want to thank you for coming by this evening. Tell us about your website and what information visitors might find there.
Wonderful. Yes, our website is www.boardsource.org. There's lots of information there in terms of resources for boards, as well as all of the research that we've mentioned, which is also available at leadingwithintent.org. I would encourage folks to visit that to learn more about our work on the Stand for Your Mission campaign to learn more about the power of possibility and lots of things that we could have going on that are relevant to organizations and leaders today.
Great. Thanks so much, Anne. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Sport is the common denominator in the world. And if there's any place where there's equality, it's really in sports.
RISE stands for the Ross Initiative in Sports for Equality. We're dedicated to promoting understanding, respect, and equality in sports and beyond.
We want people to speak up, take the pledge, and rise up against racism.
And we'll rise up.
I pledge to treat everyone
with respect,
and dignity.
I will not tolerate discrimination
or harassment of any kind.
I will speak up.
Speak up.
Whenever I know discrimination is happening, and I will stand up.
Get up.
Rise up for victims.
Take the pledge at risetowin.org.
Youth opportunities, strong communities, a healthy planet. Sounds like the work of social entrepreneurs. Yes, but it's also the work of artists. Upstart CoLab is a new national collaboration connecting artists, impact investors, and social entrepreneurs. Upstart's mission is to create opportunities for artist innovators to deliver social impact at scale. Upstart is committed to promoting artists as innovators, unleashing capital for creativity, and enabling sustainable creative lives. Find out more at www.upstartco-lab.org.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
This evening, we're going to head uptown to 103rd Street and 2nd Avenue to visit Dream. Dream, formerly Harlem RBI, has been using the power of teams to inspire youth to recognize their potential and realize their dreams since 1991. We'll start with their executive director, Rich Berlin, and then hear from other members of the Dream team.
I think in terms of organizational culture, one of the things I would like to focus on organization-wide is that historically, this has always been an organization which is both high expectations and high support for the young people who come here. We really believe in the unlimited potential of young people, and we believe it is our job to help unlock that potential and literally do whatever is necessary to get that done.
So recently, we've really been investing in ways to create official channels of communication for staff to voice their opinions or have say in office and culture matters. And we've done that most recently through our culture committee, which is really charged with creating opportunities for staff to have fun. So they plan everything from our staff parties and our like ice cream socials or our March Madness viewing parties to also finding ways to celebrate and champion people who are doing amazing work throughout the organization. And then also in like real talk to have real voice on what's going on in the org. So a real pulse check for the org. And it's our way of finding out from staff what's going on and what could be better or make us a better organization.
I feel like at Dream, my experience has been like if I say it's something I think I need and that I think will help, people are willing to support it and really give me that trust and invest in my learning. And that has been really one of the key ways that the organization has shown me that they care about me or value me.
But I think that's what's great about our organization is that not only do we have our own alum on staff, but we also look to employ as many individuals from our communities or like communities as possible in all of our roles and to really build strategic pipelines to growth to have those folks move up within our organization. So if you look at our full-time staff now, about 20% of them come from either being an alum or having been a part-time staff member or an intern within our organization. And that's what we're really looking to increase, is to increase the diversity that we have on staff in general, but then to also invest in the communities that are around us, whether it's my own friends or whether it's people who become friends and continue to be a part of our family.
But then we start to pull on threads to make sure that once they're really comfortable, that we can really reveal who they are. How, to what extent would they go to for our families and our children? What big things have they changed their mind about during their life? We'll ask them off the wall questions to see as much as possible what their true beliefs are during those. And what we have found is that the more we push there, the higher the alignment is of the people that we found. So as much as it seems like it's very scripted and seems like a traditional interview, it's far from that once you get about 20 minutes into it.
Since I came here 4 years ago, Dream has implemented something called the Teacher Career Pathway, which has been something that's been a really strong like force in me feeling like I'm becoming a better teacher, and feeling like wanting to stay a teacher is valued here. I feel like at a lot of other organizations, schools in particular, the career pathway for a teacher who's advancing is to become some type of advisor or coach or administrator. And I really like teaching, and I want to become better at teaching. And so when they implemented this teacher career pathway, there's a route and a path to take, and steps that you can get to that both acknowledge that where you are as a teacher right now and what you could become as a teacher. And I feel like it's made me feel a lot more like a professional, and that wanting to stay as a teacher and become a better teacher is really valued within the organization.
And I think the other side is what I would call deep empathy, and that is an understanding of the context within which we work. A community, a black and brown poor community, that is historically marginalized and continually marginalized by some of the structural barriers in our society. And whether you come from this community or not, you have to understand where you have empathy gaps, simply because your experience is different. And you have to be oriented toward learning and listening from people who've had different life experiences than you, because you can't do this work well unless you understand where people come from, space and place where we work.
We have decided that, why not? Let's go for like making well-rounded people and empowering people from this community to be able to contribute, right? And live the life that they want to live. And that requires a pretty complex program where we have everything from school teachers to program coordinators to communication associates to van drivers and umpires and baseball coaches and flag football coaches. And the whole idea is that everyone believes that each one of those people are central to the success of our kids. And so you can't be successful here unless you actually believe that you're going to work better if you're on a team with all of those people. So my favorite part about that is the kind of meetings that I see that are the most wonderful pairings, but so unlikely.
Maybe way to term that is I think of sort of the solution for any current complexity is greater complexity. Like, make your problem bigger. Don't make your problem smaller. Or don't try and just get stuck solving the same problem. The way to push a little rock up a hill is to find a bigger rock to push up the hill, because it's going to take more hands, it's going to take different technology, it's going to take longer, it's going to take a better strategy. So if you can figure out how to do the big rock, then surely the little rock will move that much easier.
In Culture Committee, we are continually trying to figure out what's the best way to recognize staff, what's the best way to celebrate their work.
It's a really hard thing to do when people's work is so different in this organization and is in so many different places. But the one thing that we always come back to is exposing people to each other's work. So finding ways for staff to see it in action, to experience it, is a way for staff to receive recognition if they feel like people know what they're doing. And not that this is born out of Culture Committee, but one of the things that I think is amazing about our organization is to the extent in which we work to get staff to volunteer in the organization's work.
And I think the innovation piece, so again, I've been here for over 7 years, and not one year has been the same. Every single year has been different. Every year I've had new projects to work on. I've had different skills that I've had to grow and learn in order to reach the goals that we set for ourselves. So I think we set such a high bar for ourselves, for every single person, to not do the same thing that we did the year before, but to evaluate to see what can we do better and how can we advance.
Every August, we spend 2 full days as a whole staff doing home visits. So teachers go with are paired with non-instructional staff members and visit the homes of all the students that are going to be in their class that year. And I think it's just a wonderful experience to meet with the families and the children before the year starts, start out on a positive note, demonstrate how much you care about getting to know them personally in their environment, and really starting to build that trust and that strong relationship that's going to help you have a great school year.
But it's really pretty remarkable the levels at which many of our staff go to support each other and the programs or to enrich themselves. I can't tell you how many people in this organization are tutors, how many of the people in this organization are mentors for our college students who attend locally, and then how many people are coaches, right? They coach our baseball teams, they coach our softball teams, they volunteer as a wrestling coach. And you will often see our biggest events, our galas, and those sorts of things fully staffed, not by a catering staff, but by Dream employees. And they look like they're having a blast doing it.
I want to thank all of those who took part in this segment: Hannah Kim, Felicia Crump, Katie Doctor, Amanda Yepes, Jeremy Abarno, Chris Ignatiuk, and Rich Berlin. To listen to this again, read the transcript, or see pictures of those who participated in this piece, they're all available if you come to denver-frederick.com.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org. Before you give to charity, go to CharityNavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. CharityNavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving. Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting Benetech.org. You probably know Sesame Street as the TV show that taught you letters and numbers. But Sesame is so much more. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit with a mission to help all children grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. Big Bird wants to help, so he started the Yellow Feather Fund to bring education to children in need. You can help too. Visit yellowfeatherfund.org to learn more or make a donation. That's yellowfeatherfund.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from the Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how-
Whereas we speak to the leaders of some of the largest and most well-established nonprofits on the business of giving, it's also important that we hear from those who are starting up new and exciting ventures. And one of the most promising is Emma's Torch. And here to tell you about it is Carrie Brody, its founder and executive director. Good evening, Carrie, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you so much. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Tell us about Emma's Torch and the mission of the organization.
Definitely. So Emma's Torch is a nonprofit social enterprise, and what we do is we provide culinary training and job placement services to refugees and survivors of human trafficking in New York. We're very new. We just launched our program in June, but it's been an exciting adventure, and we're already seeing the impact with our students.
How did you come up with this idea in the first place, Carrie?
So my background is actually in public policy. I was most recently working at the Human Rights Campaign in Washington, D.C., but in my spare time, I was volunteering at homeless shelters and working with different food-related causes and had this crazy idea. So many restaurants were complaining about the labor gap and that they don't have enough trained staff. And there's this huge problem of unemployment and lack of training opportunities for refugees and survivors of human trafficking. And I think I'm very fortunate. My husband eventually got sick of me telling him about this crazy idea and asked me, you know, who are you waiting for and what would it take for you to do this? So that was about 2 years ago. We moved to New York. I went to culinary school, and it's just been a really exciting adventure ever since.
It sounds that way. And share with our listeners the significance of the name of the organization, Emma's Torch.
Definitely. So Emma's Torch is named after Emma Lazarus. Emma Lazarus was a pioneering woman in the 1800s who really fought for the rights of refugees, and she's most well known for her poem, which actually is on the base of the Statue of Liberty. And so for us, it was really important to remind people that so much of our legacy as a nation and so much of what we stand for is tied to this idea of welcoming in strangers. So we like to give a little bit of a shout out to Emma Lazarus whenever we can.
Sounds good to me. What parts of the world do the refugees who are part of your program come from, and how do they find Emma's Torch in the first place?
So our students really come from all over the world. We had an English program earlier in the summer where I think we had 8 students in 7 different languages. They're from all over. We have a lot of refugees from the Middle East, asylees from West Africa, and survivors of human trafficking from South America. And they find us through partnerships that we have with some of the largest refugee resettlement agencies and homeless shelters. These agencies, from day one, helped us establish and make sure that our program was really serving the needs of the community. And now they refer in clients to our program. And so it's always the hardest part of the job is selecting the students because we're so small and there's always so much more demand. But we're hopeful that in the future we can take on more students.
Sure thing. Has the political climate under the Trump administration and their stated intents about accepting or not accepting refugees in this country impacted your program in any way?
It's been really interesting. When I started laying the groundwork for the program, the numbers we were discussing were 100,000 plus in terms of number of refugees being let into the country. And there was such a groundswell around this idea of improving social services for refugees and making that process of resettlement better and better funded. That's obviously changed in the last few months. And that's been really difficult and really, really complicated, not just in terms of funding and numbers, but also in terms of rhetoric.
Yeah.
What I will say, though, is there's also been this silver lining. The number of people, anytime there's something in the news that's hateful or feels contrary to our values, the number of people who reach out and say, how can I help? What can I do? Do you need this? Has been really inspiring. And I like to show that to my students because so often they're told, you don't belong here or we don't want you. And it's really helpful to be able to show them, no, these are people who want you. They want to see you succeed, not because you're a victim, but because you're a new member of our community.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of your students, what does your program entail? And do you offer other training beyond culinary skills?
So our program right now, our core program is an 8-week culinary apprenticeship. And so our students start with us on week one. They are learning much as they would in a general culinary school. They're learning, how do you dice a potato so every cube is identical? How do you make a sauce? How do you think through your prep list? But the twist is that the second day they're with us, they're already working in our restaurant. And our restaurant, the menu changes week to week to reflect what our students have learned and what spices and concepts they already bring from home. So that's really collaborative with our students. Towards the end of the program, we start sending them on job interviews. We have our next group of graduates are graduating next week. One already has a new full-time job that they've started this week, and the other will be interviewing at 3 different restaurants in the next 4 days. They graduate and they go on to start these careers with upward mobility. One of our first graduates already has gotten promoted, which is very exciting. And that's kind of what our program looks like.
Very sweet. Well, you're a nonprofit organization. How are you financed and what are your sources of revenue?
So we're really an interesting nonprofit in that we are both a nonprofit organization, but we also have a really strong revenue stream because we're a social enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And so we initially didn't expect for the cafe to be as profitable as it has been, which is, I mean, that's not a problem. It's a great challenge and thing that we're working on resolving. But we are funded through a combination of family foundations, some larger foundations, individual donors, and the revenue from our cafe, our catering, and our corporate gifts program. And we really like that we have both of these concepts, that we have the for-profit venture, where we're giving our students a real sense of what does it mean to run a business and what are the factors we have to think about from a restaurant perspective. But we also have the donor support, which for a young organization is something that you're really building from scratch. When I started talking about it, I guess I was 25 years old,
mm-hmm.
going to donors and saying, hey, I have this idea and I want you to trust me that I'm the person to execute it. And that public trust means a lot to me and has really gotten us to the point where we are today.
Yeah. Where is your cafe located?
We are currently located in Red Hook, Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Finally, what are your plans for going forward, Carrie, and how do you hope to scale up the organization?
We have some very, very exciting plans brewing. We're currently negotiating on a new cafe space that would be more centrally located in Brooklyn. We are not yet able to say exactly where
mm-hmm.
it is, but hopefully in the coming weeks. And then our goal is to open in the new year and scale up so that we are going to be graduating 50 students a year, which is 1% of the number of refugees who come into New York State every year.
That's very exciting. Well, Carrie Brody, the founder and executive director of Emma's Torch, thanks for being here with us this evening. For those who want to learn more about this program and what you do, your website would be?
emmastorch.org.
Thanks, Carrie. It was so good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And that is this week's show. There's a new book that stirred up a lot of conversation and interest. It's titled Engine of Impact, Essentials of Strategic Leadership in the Nonprofit Sector. And next week, I'll be joined by its co-authors, William Meehan and Kim Yonker. So you'll want to be here for that. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And I hope you'll be back next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.